We're speaking with Matt Grokoff, who's the founder of the Thrive Collaborative in Ann Arbor. He'll also be the keynote speaker at the Reaching for Zero conference in Kalamazoo this week. Matt, thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
What exactly is a net zero building?
A net zero building is pretty simple. It's a building that harvests all of its energy that it needs on site over the course of the year. Without combustion and powered with renewable energy. So, for example, my own home we bought in 2006. It was built in 1901. So it's a 117-year-old folk Victorian home with no insulation, asbestos siding, no insulation in the attic. And we were able to upgrade all the appliances, upgrade the HVAC system, put in a geothermal system, put in as much insulation as we could into an old house. It's worth noting that we actually did this to historic preservation standards. And then after reducing that energy so much and then making the house more comfortable and then putting solar panels on the roof in 2010, we have not paid a utility bill since March of 2011. And over the course of the year, we produce more energy than we consume over the course of that year. So it's pretty simple. And most importantly, it's entirely necessary. We're going to have to see a lot more net zero buildings going forward in the future if we're going to manage the quickly changing energy fields and climate change.
Now, your house, as you mentioned, is quite elderly, if I can use that term, but could be successfully.
No one's ever used that term, but that's a great word for it. Yeah, but it's got great bones. It doesn't have osteoporosis.
Yeah, it's a maybe vintage is a better term for it.
That's a great term.
So obviously, we're not talking about just new buildings, but if a new home or new building is being constructed, are people starting to build structures with this idea in mind?
Yes. In fact, California is requiring that all new homes and buildings be built to this standard going forward. It's happening virtually all over the world. The first step for this is really just electrification. A lot of cities have pledged to, you know, maintain part of the Paris Climate Accords. And the Paris Climate Accords basically calls for a certain level of CO2 reduction in the atmosphere. And if we're to achieve those goals, we have to stop burning these old school fuels, stop digging things out of the ground and shipping them around the world or to other states like we do in Michigan, and harvesting the energy from elsewhere and then bringing it to where you need it. With the net zero concept, you're actually harvesting the energy where it is used, right there on the site. And so it operates as elegantly as things in the natural world, as flowers and trees do. They don't get to go across the street to get the energy or a drink of water. They have to harvest those things right where they are, and they're sustainable without us. And without man-made machines, they create their own biological machines. So in a sense, these renewable energies are getting back to those biological process using human-made machines.
Are most of these buildings using some form of solar energy to derive their energy, or are there other ways to do this?
Yeah, most buildings are using solar power to harvest the energy. Wind is a wonderful option. In fact, wind is one of the least expensive forms of energy on the planet right now. Interestingly enough, the price of solar has dropped so much that it is now the cheapest energy on the planet. Arizona just announced a deal for less than 2 cents a kilowatt hour on the wholesale level. So you can imagine in Michigan, we're spending 15 cents a kilowatt hour on the retail side of things. If DTE were able to deliver that energy to us or harvest that energy for 2 cents a kilowatt hour, then they could lower our utility bills overall over time. So again, this is where editing comes in. So
I gather that there's this concept of being, you know, off the grid, where you're pretty much you're generating all of your own energy all of the time, but you don't have to be that to be a net zero building, correct?
No, there's a big misconception about net zero energy as being off grid. There was a short time where if you Googled off the grid, my house came up, and there was a huge misconception about that. And nature doesn't do off grid. It does on network. Those are the most resilient systems. So what we're really looking for is an internet of energy. So you have pockets of energy being harvested, pockets of energy being stored, shared amongst itself in very local levels. And then connected to other pockets of energy that are being harvested and stored as well. So you, just like the internet, you have different nodes of energy, neighborhoods, homes, buildings that are producing their own energy and have their own infrastructure, and then are connected with the macro grid, what we call the grid. And those smaller networks of energy can share energy with the bigger networks of energy and move these electrons as the big grid does now. But instead of being produced in a central place, it's produced everywhere. It's produced on rooftops. It's produced in fields. It's produced on shorelines. It's produced on mountaintops. It's produced everywhere. But most of the energy is being produced right where it is being consumed, and then shifted for the time of day through battery storage and things like that. And the cost of batteries and solar has come down so much that places that have had issues with resiliency, where there's been severe weather events. So New York State after Hurricane Sandy, Miami after the hurricane last year, Houston, Texas, Puerto Rico, all of these places are now very heavily investing in solar and battery storage. And Australia, who, you know, is not an energy rich nation, and they've got to ship everything across a vast ocean, has had dramatic issues with their energy grid. So they are now shifting away from these centralized coal plants to giant renewable energy fields, rooftop solar and battery storage, to create what they're calling virtual power plants. And Germany is really the pioneer in this. There's companies like Sonnen Battery who are actually running what they call, again, virtual power plants. So they'll put a solar panel up on your roof. You can put a battery pack in your basement if you choose to. And then there's larger areas where there's fields full of solar and battery packs. And you in Germany, you can actually sell energy back to other people on that network of energy. So it's really this networked grid rather than a linear boxed grid that we have now, that if the current system, if a squirrel chews on a line like it did years ago and knocked out the entire eastern seaboard, the entire grid goes down when a tree limb falls on a local transformer. Whereas net zero energy buildings with solar power can be part of microgrids. And what happens there is that if the larger grid system goes down so that these other smaller systems can't share energy with each other, they may not be able to share energy during that storm event, but they'll be able to continue using energy that they are currently harvesting and energy that they previously stored, and then continue to do that until the storm event stops. So you don't have these 10-day power outages anymore. You have these really, really resilient microgrids. And microgrids is something that is really being looked at by cities and municipalities to harden their critical infrastructure. So what's happened in these other areas where there's, you know, tornadoes, hurricanes, storms, earthquakes, whatever it might be, the first thing that happens is these places that we rely on to recover from those things don't have the resources, as basic as plugging in the cell phone for the police department, right? a fire truck or communications tools, anything like that. They don't even have the power to do that. And Hurricane Sandy, this was a major problem. Hospitals down in Houston, Texas, who had their resiliency backup were these giant gas generators. Well, the problem was some of those gas lines were damaged, and you couldn't get gas to it. There were other people who used tanks so that they could have their own fuel storage. Well, you know, after a couple of days, those tanks ran dry and they couldn't be refueled. So their plan relied on this constant refueling. Well, if you can't get a truck through Louisiana to get to Houston, Texas, good luck. And then other systems that were using, battery and solar storage could stay live. They could keep their energy going. So hospitals now are converting to these combinations of systems where you have multiple levels of resiliency. And you could be harvesting energy during the day, storing that excess energy, using it at nighttime, and the cycle can continue as long as you're not exceeding the capacity of those batteries in the solar. And then when the grid comes back up, you can start sharing energy again and pulling from the grid when you need it, giving it back when you don't, and creating basically the energy system of the future. It's coming. Whether we move there fast enough is really up to innovators and, most importantly, policymakers to get this done and really level the playing field for anyone who wants to play in it.
And that does bring up a question I was going to ask, and that is, you know, what are the obstacles, bureaucratic or otherwise, to this in terms of policy that are not helping this happen?
Yeah, Michigan is actually really far behind in this. We just haven't caught up with the innovation. It's unclear why. We don't have our own energy systems here in Michigan except for solar and wind. We have a little bit of natural gas, but nothing significant, not enough to power the state for sure. All of our energy is shipped in from other places. So I think it's just it's like Kodak. It's just kind of just institutionalized inertia, right? And the funny thing about Kodak was that they owned digital technology, and they didn't. While there were individuals inside these companies that saw what was coming, they didn't adapt. And so the utility companies now are looking very quickly to adapt. Consumers Energy just came out with some really neat numbers this week that they're going to be really pushing towards renewable energy and battery storage and things like that. The companies that failed to do that, the utility industry gave a report a couple of years ago that said that as more and more people come online, as more IKEAs start to realize that they can put their own energy up on their rooftops, that they're going to be in what they call the utility death spiral. That was an industry term they used. So they can either, you know, fight against this progress or become part of it. And fortunately, a lot of the utility companies around the country are rapidly becoming a part of it and partnering with you know, other for-profit businesses. So down in Georgia, Pulte Homes and the power company down there are doing a microgrid. In Arizona, Sonnen Battery is partnering with a company called Mandalay. They are building a neighborhood of 5,000 homes. It's basically almost a small town that will be powered by renewable energy and have battery storage. And they're creating a virtual power plant in partnership with the Arizona Public Utility out there, or the power service out there. So it's pretty neat.
We've been talking mostly about private homes using a net zero approach, but can this also be used for, you know, very large buildings like, you know, the skyscrapers in New York and Chicago?
Yeah, that's an interesting place. I mean, obviously, the taller you go, the more difficult it is to harvest your own energy. That's why we don't have 2,000-foot tall trees, right? They would grow that tall if they could harvest enough energy and harvest enough water. We kind of sever that relationship with nature, and we just keep building taller and taller and taller until nature pushes back a little. So yes, tall buildings are more challenging, but that's, again, there's all kinds of innovations there that while they have small rooftops, they have lots of glass surfaces. There are buildings now that are looking to, you know, clad the entire sides of the building in solar panels. There's a building in a taller building in Pittsburgh that I believe is targeting to be the tallest net zero energy building in the world. But that said, not every building has to be net zero. That's what solar fields and wind farms are all about. You can have this combination of distributed energy, some centralized energy, but even the centralized energy can be very near to the users. We don't need to be building a solar field the size of the state of Arizona out in the desert and put power lines to power the entire country with the solar they harvest in Arizona. That's not necessary. Every region of the country, including Alaska, has the ability to harvest a lot of energy. The world's leader in solar right now one of the world's leaders in solar is Germany. And they're much farther north than Michigan is. There's a building in Seattle called the Bullitt Center, which is home of the Living Future Institute. And it's a six-story building. It's about the size of a Ann Arbor City Hall building. It's a pretty large building, six stories tall with a basement. It harvests 125% of all of the energy that it needs right there on site. So every year it's putting 25% more energy back to the grid than it's taking from it. It doesn't even have a sewer tap. It's even harvesting all of its own water. So with this, with off-the-shelf technology and just really smart engineering, they've created a building that is operating as elegantly as a flower, harvesting all of its energy and water right there on site and creating almost no waste coming out of that building. What's neat about that is that it's to give you an idea of Seattle is and how much sun they have, right? It's known for being sunny Seattle, right? They get just about more rain than anybody else in the country, and they are located, if you drive up to Traverse City and then travel 3 hours north, that's the same latitude as Seattle, Washington. And this building is in a downtown area. So all these buildings are showing that it's possible. And now not only know that it's possible, it's becoming cheaper than any other form of energy. My solar panels that were purchased in 2010, in late 2010, were almost $7 a kilowatt or per watt installed. Today, that number is about $2.30 here in Ann Arbor. So that you can see the dramatic, dramatic drop. And that's not including any kind of federal tax incentives or net metering rules or anything like that. That's just talking about the pure cost of solar. And the cost is coming down even further. The challenge now is getting enough people in the industry to work in the industry. The solar industry in Michigan employs it would be the third largest utility company by size of the number of employees. So there's, I believe it's 4,000 people employed in the solar industry in Michigan. So it's pretty extraordinary thing that's happening. And, Michigan needs to get on board as quickly as possible. We're going to be left behind other states, and we're going to see, jobs lost here to other states that are really inviting the kind of innovative companies, into their states.
You know, someone has heard this interview and says, you know, I want to make my house a net zero house, or I'm building a new house and I want it to be a net zero house. What is your advice for them to make that happen?
For a new home, and especially if you can choose your own property, absolutely, no question. There's no excuse any longer for not doing net zero energy. I worked on a project with Habitat for Humanity in Traverse City that built 10 net zero energy homes for a total cost of $150,000 a piece. These homes don't have any energy bills, or very, very low ones for a couple of them. So price is no longer an obstacle. There's a lot of mythology out there about what it takes to be a net zero energy building. You hear architects saying, well, they're more expensive. It's not true. They're more complicated to do. It's not true. You need triple pane windows, really expensive glass. It's not true. You need to have a passive house. It's not true. My house is a testament to that. I've got a 117-year-old house. It's basically violating all of the rules. We don't have a lot of insulation. We have as much as we can have. I'd love to have more, but it's an old house. I can't put more in it. So we have a larger solar array. We have a larger geothermal system than we would have needed otherwise. But for a new house, it's really just a matter of you can get good windows. And you don't need the absolute best, but you can get very good windows, better than were built, you know, in 1901, as far as air leakage and things like that. So once the house is insulated well, sealed up really well, then it's a matter of how much is the house using. Those first two things are how much does the house lose in energy. So you want to lose less energy, first of all. Then you want to put in appliances. So first being all electric, there's, you know, heat pump clothes dryers, which right there you can save two solar panels worth of energy just by putting in a heat pump clothes dryer. Again, these are extraordinarily popular in Europe. They're just now starting to show up in our stores here. And they're some of the best dryers that you can buy. And what it does is there's no vent anymore. So instead of piping the hot, wet air outside your house in the middle of winter, you're recirculating that air and putting it back into the dryer. So this hot heat energy is being used over and over again inside of the dryer. Heat pump water heaters, same thing, using that heat pump technology, drawing the hot air from my basement right now as we speak, cooling off the basement, dehumidifying it, and putting that heat energy into the water tank so that I get virtually free hot water during the summertime when I'm running the air condition and the heat pump water heater is running as well. Geothermal systems, a heat pump is basically just a giant heat pump that you use for the ground. There's air source heat pumps that are very, very affordable and have improved dramatically over the past few years. They'll operate down to minus 20 degrees, so they're perfectly appropriate for here in Michigan, and they're far less expensive than geothermal is. And not much more expensive than a conventional heater and air conditioner. And that's the other benefit of a heat pump. You get heating and air conditioning in one unit. And then the most importantly, the other biggest energy user in the house is your stove and your oven. If we truly want to disconnect these pipelines that are running gas through the state of Michigan, and there's pipeline protests all over the place, we're talking about shutting down Line 5. And it's like, and I argue that those pipelines all end inside your kitchen. And so one of the greatest devices that's been becoming popular now is the induction cooktop. I love to cook. My wife and I cook all the time. We cook with precision. We bake. We do all kinds of desserts. We do you name it. So temperature control is incredibly important. The induction cooktops use far less energy than a gas stove or an electric stove. They're about 95% efficient versus 45% efficient for a conventional gas stove. But it'll boil, because of that efficiency, it'll boil a pot of water less than twice as fast as a commercial gas range will. So whereas it'll take you 7 minutes to boil a liter of water, on a regular stove, on a conventional induction stove for a resident that you can buy anywhere from Lowe's to Home Depot now, you can boil that water in about 2.5 minutes. And then on the low end, it's incredibly dynamic. It gets very, very low heat, and it's very evenly distributed. So chefs love these things. Now in Europe, over half the stoves installed in Europe are induction cooktops, and they're becoming rapidly adopted here, mostly in the luxury home building industry. But they're starting to be available now at a much, much lower price range and available for normal residences. So that's really it. So it's committing to being all electric, putting in heat pumps, clothes dryers, heaters, and hot water heaters. And then induction cooktops, and really putting all of these things in, you've already dramatically reduced. You can reduce the energy by more than 50% just by that list of items I said, plus efficient LED lighting controls. So the lights are all turning off when you leave your home. All the stuff is available off the shelf now. Nothing has to be invented anymore. This is an exciting time to be in. I mean, imagine that in the next 10 years, our children are going to grow up in a world where they'll live in all electric homes powered by the sun right there on their own site. And they don't have to worry. They're going to look at us and say, a power outage? Daddy, what's a power outage? Oh, back in the day when a tree limb hit a power line, the power would go out. But now we have these solar panels and these batteries in the basement. So for them, It's just a normal way of life, and that's pretty exciting. And again, it's much cleaner and healthier, and we're not contributing to climate change, which is absolutely essential.
We've been speaking with Matt Grokoff of the Thrive Collaborative in Ann Arbor. He'll be the keynote speaker at the Reaching for Zero conference at the Fetzer Center on the campus of Western Michigan University. That'll be on Wednesday, June 20th, from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Matt, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. And if I could add one more thing, a big shout out for that event as well. Anybody who wants to learn about net zero energy, there are not enough people in the industry to handle all of the buildings and things that are being done right now. So for those builders, craftsmen, tradespeople who want to get into net zero energy, this is the conference to come to.